Michelle Kellerman, National Public Radio. Just a very quick question. That is, what role do you see Egypt playing as sort of the go-between between the U.S. and Hamas?
Alan?
All right. I think there's a tendency to side-skirt the legal issue, which is not insignificant, because you began your presentation by saying that for, quote, legal and political considerations, the United States cannot engage. And then you went on to give a very articulate brief of about 10 reasons as to why the United States should, in fact, engage. Now, the central reason why Hamas is on the U.S. terrorism list is because it has been found to be committed to terrorism, and not only the kind of terrorism that the PLO has engaged in, but as a U.S. District Court recently found in distinguishing PLO terrorism from Hamas terrorism, that Hamas terrorism is a means to an end, and that end is genocidal in the classic sense of the destruction of a political entity, Israel. So if you believe that Hamas remains committed towards that goal, then that must shape all of the policy recommendations you're making. So my question is, do you believe that Hamas is in a position where it can renounce, for no explicit quid pro quo, but renounce, because that's the precondition for getting off any terrorism list, is it in a position where it can renounce its allegiance to terrorism, especially genocidal terrorism as inscribed in its own charter? And if it is not, how can we go forward in any of the ceasefire and other suggestions you have made?
Stanley?
Stanley Kovar with the Cato Institute. How does Iran's relationship with Hamas affect your analysis?
Okay. There was on this side. Yes, please.
Dan Pollack with the Zionist Organization of America. In regard to U.S. policy, even if we don't explicitly talk with Hamas, what would be the effects, and this is mainly for Mr. Malley, what would be the effects of our more general, quote, war against terror, or whatever you want to call it, of granting Hamas the type of recognition involved in the plan you outlined? And would that serve other U.S. policy purposes, or would it actually be to the detriment of them?
Rob, do you want to start with
Sure.
this group?
A lot of these questions seem, at least the ones that I'll address most directly, premise on the notion that I was saying the U.S. should engage Hamas. I thought I'd been clear, and if I wasn't clear, I will say it again. I don't know that that's a particularly relevant question today. As you said, as a number of people have said, there are many reasons why it won't, perhaps it shouldn't, engage Hamas. And nothing I've said, by the way, requires, entails U.S. talking to Hamas. I don't see why they'd have to do anything that I spoke about. The U.S. could maintain exactly the same position towards Hamas. I suspect it will for many of the reasons that you said, and I'm not arguing for the opposite. What I'm saying is that, first of all, other parties are engaging with Hamas, and the question is to what end? What do we see as a way to achieve, again, some of the outcomes that I spoke about, an end to the violence and a way to facilitate the talks between Abbas and Olmert. And for those, I think there are different ways of doing this. There's going to have to be some communication to Hamas. Some of it is taking place already. Frankly, I think, you know, if others talk to Hamas and can communicate, can convey very clearly to Hamas what are the conditions it's going to have to meet if it ever wants a dialogue with the U.S. Talks about talks, not with the U.S., but with others. I have no problem with that. If the Egyptians, if the Norwegians, if whoever is talking to Hamas can very clearly state to them, listen, because some of them live under illusions. And having met with them, I can tell you their understanding of U.S. policy and U.S. politics is extremely low, to make clear some red lines so that they know, so that it's not a gift, as you say, to other groups. I think that's those are messages that could be sent that don't have to be sent by us. Other countries are well aware of what our policy is. I want to make one other point in response to something Rob said, because I didn't clarify that. The notion that if Hamas, that those are calling for unity and peace process are calling for two things that are incompatible. Unity doesn't mean unanimity. When people say unity, at least when I say unity, I mean Hamas has to be brought back into the political system and not be outside where it feels completely unconstrained and feels every justification in view of its own constituents to launch rockets because, you know, what's the alternative? Putting them in the system and even having them, as I say, at some point they may lose. If there's a referendum and the referendum is 51-49, they could be in the opposition, they could be in the minority. The question is, are they outside the political fabric, or as Mecca had envisioned, are they brought in? I think that for me is a question. I don't have any doubt in my mind that if a deal is struck between Abbas and Olmert, Hamas will oppose it. The question is, what resonance will its opposition have? What resonance with the Palestinian people will it have? What means will it feel free to use to try to translate that opposition into blocking the accord? And will it let a referendum be carried through, or will, because Gaza and the West Bank remain divided, will they make sure that there will be no referendum in Gaza, in which case Abbas could never claim legitimacy for the agreement, even if it is passes in the West Bank? In terms of Egypt, I mean, Egypt is in a very awkward position. I mean, it on the one hand, it has as much fear of Hamas as probably the Israelis do, and has no desire to see Hamas grow, perhaps create, become a model for and inspire the Muslim Brotherhood in its own country. On the other hand, and this has been more clearly seen over the last several weeks, particularly since the breach of the wall, they understand this is a reality they have to deal with. So I have no doubt that, their goal would be to see Hamas's power reduced as much as possible. But they've gone through a number of iterations of their own policy. I think they're still going through them. And one thing they keep coming that knocking against is the fact that Hamas exists, that Hamas has the ability, not only through violence, but even more creative means like breaching the wall, to make sure that we may want to isolate Gaza, but Gaza will find a way to remind us that it continues to exist. Why don't I let you take those and others? I know there's some I didn't answer.
Thank you. Just a couple of points. I know, and Rob correctly says that he didn't advocate for U.S. engagement, but what he did say is should it be the U.S. position that reconciliation is good, that reconciliation is a good idea? And that is indeed the fundamental question. Should it be the U.S. position that reconciliation between Hamas and Abbas is something that will advance the cause of a two-state solution? Or, alternatively, is it our view that reconciliation between Hamas and Abbas is more likely to bring Abbas, or what is left of the remnant of the PA, closer to the view of Hamas, strengthening those who oppose a two-state solution, or throwing too many burdens onto the pathway of peacemaking, that anything that resembles progress toward a two-state solution is in fact a sham? That, I think, is the real question. And here, as you can guess, I fundamentally disagree. It was how many years that the United States had as its position that any engagement with the PLO would be conditioned on PLO acceptance of 242, renunciation of terrorism, and recognition of Israel's right to exist. It was a hell of a lot longer than 2.5 years. It was many, many years. Why we should think that a position that worked regarding the PLO has failed so abysmally in just 2 years that we should chuck it and throw away these conditions and give what it would seem to be a major concession to Hamas, and in the process undermining what is left of the party that met the conditions 20 years ago, that to me is the fundamental point. Rob, I think, very powerfully made an argument as to how one would bring about this process of reconciliation. Referendum, bringing them into the system, giving them a stake in the process. We have to remember what we're talking about here. This is not Republicans and Democrats. These are not people who agree on the basic contours of what the system is all about, or what the purpose of the politics in which they're engaged is all about. It is It would be far more like, Stalinists and Republicans, not Republicans and Democrats. That's the breadth of the fundamental division between advocates of a two-state repartition of Palestine and advocates of a one-state destruction of Israel. And we can, skirt around this, but we can't make this go away. And here, the Iranians actually play a very pernicious role. There was a fascinating interview, I think it was the Associated Press reporter, although I may be wrong, did a fascinating interview last week with a Hamas commander, as it were, in Gaza. And this unnamed but otherwise well-characterized person, what he was wearing, how his hair was combed, et cetera, described the hundreds of Hamas fighters that are getting training in Iran, a much fewer number that are getting training in Syria, but the hundreds that are getting training in Iran, the sort of training they receive, how they have internet connections so that useful tactical suggestions don't have to wait for these guys to transit through Egypt and back into Gaza. It was the boldest, most open discussion of the ongoing and direct Iranian role in training and equipping Hamas fighters that I had yet seen. I think the connection rather is absolutely clear, and anything that is done to even unwittingly legitimize the Hamas presence will just give greater avenue for Iranian infiltration into Gaza. It's not the reason not to do it, but it is an additional reason not to legitimize it. Marvin and Dennis in the back, and then I'll move back up front here.
Marvin Ford with APEC. I just wanted to ask Rob.
Make sure the button is pushed. Oh. It's on? Then speak right now.
Okay, sorry. Rob, you reviewed the reasons you think why the current policy has failed. There's also been an effort through the years, starting initially with the Turks, but also in the effort to lead to the Mecca Agreement, to engage Hamas, to get Hamas to accept a movement toward the two-state solution, at least accepting the all previous agreements that would sort of be the, if you compressed all three conditions down to one, it would be accepting the previous agreements reached by the PLO. And do you have any evidence that indicates that Hamas ultimately, I would say to you that these efforts also clearly failed. They failed when Abbas undertook them. They failed when the Turks undertook them. They failed when others have gone to Hamas and laid out very clearly the kinds of steps that they would need to take. Do you have any evidence that indicates to you there's a prospect that Hamas would be willing to enter the process with the ultimate objective being to come to the two-state solution that Rob Salloff has outlined so clearly?
Dennis?
I have a question for each of you. Let me start with Rob Malley. Rob, one issue on the question of reconciliation right now is that Abu Mazen has no interest in it. I mean, he has said he's prepared to mediate between the Israelis and Hamas as it relates to a ceasefire in Gaza, but he's also made it very clear when it comes to changing anything with Hamas, Hamas is the one that has to, one, undo, in his words, the coup. Not just the polities, but undo the coup. And he's made it very clear he's not interested in going back unless they're prepared to give up what they have in Gaza. So I, in a sense, what you're calling for requires us to pressure Abu Mazen to move down a path, I think, unless I don't understand what you're suggesting. Anyway, I would like you to clarify that. Rob, for you, on the issue of a ceasefire, one can say it's fine to isolate Hamas, but obviously Hamas is demonstrating they have the capacity not to be so easily isolated and not to be ignored. Gaza remains an accident waiting to happen in terms of a rocket hitting the wrong target in Israel and Israel going in not just to take a small slice of territory, but to be in for what will be a fairly long time. What if one actually could produce a real ceasefire, including preventing the smuggling of rockets in so they couldn't be rebuilt? The crossing points would be run by the PA. You were making a reference to it. But that Hamas would actually have to stop all resistance. You made a point of describing who Hamas is correctly. They're the Islamic resistance movement. Well, resistance is a credo for them. Well, what happens when they actually stop all others from engaging in resistance, something they've never been prepared to do before? Does that represent some kind of signal change or not?
Sarah up in front, then we'll work our way back over here.
Thank you. My question is for Rob Malley. Maybe I'll just say it. Okay, I actually...
you got to do it in the mic, please.
Can you hear it?
Yes.
Okay. I'm actually going to be unique and agree with your conclusion that you have to look at the core test, and the core test is whether or not what we are doing right now is working. However, I think you might want to entertain the idea of whether or not you're making a major basic fallacy in social science that correlation is not a causal connection. There are many, many other factors here that we have to look at. One factor is the education and the incitement to hate and to kill. And possibly that is at the root of Hamas's popularity right now.
Okay, why don't we take these three? Rob, you want to
Sure.
Start?
First question, which both Rob and Dennis raises, the whole question of unity and reconciliation. Dennis raises an obvious, obviously a powerful point, which is one of the biggest obstacles today to unity and reconciliation, or one of the people who opposes it most, is Abbas, undoubtedly. My point is certainly not that the U.S. should start pressuring Abbas to do something, or as you say, that Rob said, that the U.S. should encourage reconciliation. My experience is the more the U.S. stays out of Palestinian politics, the best we all are, because it tends to backfire. I say let the U.S. not threaten or not remove its veto if the Palestinians decide that they are prepared at some point, which I assume at some point they will be, if they decide that they want to come back to some kind of arrangement. Right now, one of the arguments Abbas uses is, if I get back with Hamas, it's the end of the peace process, it's the end of U.S. support, it's the end. Now, I think those questions, how the U.S. would deal with a renewed Mecca-type government, should be addressed based on what that government stands for, what its actions are. You know, we could then have very clear tests for that government. Does it accept the Arab Peace Initiative? Is it committed to a ceasefire, et cetera, et cetera? And then you could decide whether or not you want to deal with that government, deal with nobody, or whatnot. But right now, what appears to Palestinians as a blanket veto is certainly exercising an effect. I wouldn't argue it's the only one. I think Abbas has very deep personal reasons right now why he does not want to engage in a dialogue with Hamas. That view, which was widespread, as Dennis knows, was widespread within Fatah for a long time, is beginning to erode. You hear more and more of the young Fatah, particularly those who are close to Barghouti, saying this is suicide, not simply, I mean, suicide for the Palestinian national cause, it's suicide for us as Fatah. As long as this disunity remains, we are going to get weaker. And I heard that just last month in Ramallah from people who were not saying that 6 months and a year ago. So again, I think the point is for the U.S., not to try to prevent it, not to encourage it, take a step back. The question about, which actually was raised in the previous question as well, having to do with whether Hamas could change its views. I have no idea. I suspect more hours with Hamas leaders than most people in this room. I don't come out of it in any way confident that it just, that's why I said it's a mythology to think, talk to Hamas and suddenly they're going to accept the two-state solution, renounce terror. No. One of the pillars of Hamas's belief, other than its religious aspect, is it is the anti-Fatah. In other words, it believes that everything Fatah did was wrong. And one thing it doesn't want to do, and this will be very, the top leaders will be very overt about it. They'll say, there may be things that we could accept in the future. Now, that could be a trick to please their interlocutor, but they say there may be things we could accept in the future. One thing we won't do is what Fatah did, which is to accept things in advance without knowing exactly what we get in exchange. And so don't count on us to do that. And I think for that reason, but also for deep religious reasons, the notion that Hamas any day soon is going to say, we recognize Israel, we accept the two-state solution, I think that's out of the question. I think that, again, for a whole host of political but also deeply held religious beliefs. So my view is not premised on the fact that by talking to them, suddenly they're going to change their view. I'm interested right now in changing their behavior, in Gaza, changing their behavior vis-a-vis Abbas, vis-a-vis other things, and that's going to involve a give and take, and even that may fail. But what I think they've been asked since their election, they've been asked to do things that are hardest for them to do and possibly less meaningful for Israel to get. You know, even if they accepted the three conditions, which, as Rob said, that the PLO did and Arafat did, does that necessarily translate into change of behavior? I mean, many people in this room have argued very articulately for many years, Arafat says the right thing, but he doesn't mean them. What matters is what he's doing on the ground. Is he really stopping violence? Well, that's a fair case to be made. In the case of Hamas, we've asked them to say, to mouth things that would be ideological betrayals for them, and which they won't do, and if they did, I'm not sure what they would mean, rather than ask them to do things which may be easier for them to do, stop the violence, allow Abbas to negotiate a deal, and then abide by whatever outcome that is, even as an opposition. But that could be really meaningful, because if the violence stopped and if other things, positive things happened, you may create a different dynamic. Again, I don't want to be naive in thinking that that dynamic is going to be irresistible and Hamas is going to become something that we all want to deal with. But I think you have a better chance of changing its behavior right now than changing its worldview. And by changing its behavior, you may actually lead to something more. But again, to be clear, I don't expect them to accept the three conditions or to accept any variant of them in the near term, even the medium term.
I appreciate Rob's honesty about this point, or Rob's candor on this point. I mean, there are some who argue the opposite, which is, oh, if we only go down a route of engagement, then their true peacemaking colors would come out. This is not the argument that Rob is making. And I think in this room we should all be pretty clear that nobody of any seriousness is making the argument that that engagement would trigger this sort of internal eruption of soul searching on the part of key leaders of Hamas on a different strategy. Now, Rob just made a point about the difference between a view and behavior. I make this point when I look at public opinion polling, the difference between attitude and behavior. But I think there's somewhat of a difference here. It's really, what is your political objective? And then what is your tactics to achieve it? I mean, it is necessary to change your tactics, but it is certainly not sufficient to change your tactics. I mean, it is fundamentally most important to change your course, to change your objective. If it's merely a different set of tactics to achieve the same goal, why the United States or any other international partner would want to be complicit in this is a bit odd. I think on the question that Dennis asked, I just think the position that the United States will have no view on that we should just have no opinion, essentially, when our State Department spokesman is asked, is Mecca 2 a good idea or a bad idea? Well, this is an internal Palestinian debate in which we have no view. I just don't think that's sustainable. There's one party that receives hundreds of millions of dollars of U.S. economic assistance. There's another party that is a designated terrorist organization. We cannot have no view on whether a marriage between these two parties advances or detracts from American interest. I just don't think in a practical sense that's realistic. I think we got sandbagged the first time, and we took a lot of heat for it the first time. And I just don't think in a practical sense it's realistic that we will have no view the second time. Dennis, you asked me a very serious question, or an important question, about a ceasefire, or at least the sort of ceasefire that is in the air that people are talking about. Would that signal a fundamental change, sort of an implicit fundamental change on the part of Hamas? Well, First, I'm very skeptical about hearing the terms of the ceasefire that have been, that are out there in the ether. I'm skeptical at the idea, for example, that Abbas loyalists would in fact man the border. What does this mean? 700, 800, 1,000 guys, what would they do? Where would they live? Would they be under Hamas control except from 9 to 5? Who would actually control their movement? Who would control their weapons? Who would be really in charge of their existence along the Gaza-Egypt border? I think, while I recognize the symbolic attraction this is to strengthen Abbas's position, I think it's a bit of a trap. If you came back to me after a year, 2 years, 5 years of it being implemented, and it had been implemented, then I would be willing to eat my hat. But I think the chances that the presence of that 500, 1,000 Abbas loyalists on the border can be expanded with essentially with Hamas's connivance, which is really what this is all about, expanded as into expanding Abbas's political influence in Gaza. I just don't see how or why Hamas is going to be party to its own growing irrelevance. And that's quite apart from the problems of merely just resurrecting the European role as it was before and the ineffective European role as it was before. But so I suppose, yes, if Hamas were willing to undermine its own position, yes, that would be a signal change in Hamas's policy. But since I don't think Hamas is going to undermine its own position, it's tough to imagine how this will, in fact, persist over time. Yes, Paul?
This is defective, so I'll try to shout unless you
I'd like to go into that fundamental question that Rob Satloff raised about that in the last round was being discussed about Hamas's long-term intentions, and I'd like to question its relevancy in certain ways. Also, looking at the historical analogies, I'm not sure that during the 80s, Israel's refusal to talk to the PLO until it accepted certain conditions was that important. I think the breakdown of the Soviet Union, which came in a different direction, was far, far more important. And we already saw Yehoshaphat Harkavi, the hawk of hawks in the 60s and the early 70s, by the late 70s and 80s, had seen, who was watching at that time the PLO more than anyone else, saw the changes that were already taking place. But I think the fundamental analogy between the PLO and the and Hamas in some ways is wrong, because the difference that you're pointing out. The words you use, Rob, I think are identical to what Israeli spokesmen were saying in the mid-80s, that if the PLO accepts Israel, it will no longer be the PLO. I think that's a verbatim quote of what was said. And clearly, they were wrong. That doesn't prove you were right or wrong. But ultimately, I think what I hear from Islamists, I haven't talked to them, to the Hamas people as much as Rob has, is that there is a fundamental recognition that Israel exists. They don't like it, but the question is, how do you survive in this environment? And what they're looking for is a long-term hudna in the hope and expectation Israel will disappear. However, the question is, given if they are brought in for the pragmatic reasons that Rob Malley is talking about, and Israel will keep guard, as we know it will, over the long term, if they agree to do it, as they said they were, in as they indicated when they won the election. They didn't expect to win the election at all. They expected they would be a minority party and Abu Mazen would negotiate. So my question is, given that I think they have shown a willingness to participate for their own reasons may change over the longer term, why is it not in the interests of both sides to look at the possibilities, remaining on guard that Hamas does not ideologically accept Israel, and seeing whether over a generation that will change?
Jerome? Briefly, please, Jerome.
Jerome Siegel, University of Maryland. My question is to Rob. Rob, Rob Malley. Rob, essentially you were, as I heard it, suggesting replacing substantive conditions on Hamas, such as that they accept Israel's right to exist, with procedural ones, basically that they accept that Abu Mazen, as head of the PLO, will negotiate for the Palestinians, provided that a negotiated treaty is ratified and that they accept the idea of a referendum as a mode of ratification. Now, we know that that's not pie in the sky, because Hamas already accepted that, both in the Mecca agreement and even outside of a unity agreement in the Fatah-Hamas discussions after the prisoners document. But my question to you is this. Hamas was willing to enter into this kind of procedural agreement. The big problem is, in terms of Palestinian politics, that Fatah broke faith with democratic procedure by basically participating from the beginning in an effort to prevent Hamas from ruling after it won the elections. And so the question is, how or why or what would Hamas have to see in order for it to be convinced, in fact, that in the future Fatah, the United States, and Israel would abide by democratic procedures, which translates into the question, if in a Palestinian state Hamas won future elections, would they be allowed to rule, provided that they recognize the treaty as legitimate international law because it was ratified?
Do you want to?
Okay, so this is it?
Yeah, this is it.
Oh, this is it. I mean, just a few questions here. One about the question of intentions. Many Israelis to the last day, and many of them even more so after the last day, questions what Arafat's long-term intentions might have been. I think Dennis has written extensively about that. You know, intentions can remain very problematic for a very long time. And in politics, one deals at best with stated intentions and with practical behavior. You could always try to divine what the intentions are. Hamas may be more honest than others, I don't know. But as I said, I think right now the most we can do is to focus on what I would call, you know, their behavior in terms of, or their attitudes in terms of a ceasefire. Are they prepared to really enforce it? And in terms of the attitude towards the negotiations that take place. Which brings me to Jerome's question. I'm not suggesting, I mean, you say replacing the conditions with a behavior test. Conditions for what? Again, I'm not saying the U.S. could start talking to Hamas if it imposes ceasefire. I'm saying these are how others may be able to judge Hamas and then bring it up. And by the way, the ceasefire would be not simply declaratory. Yes, Hamas has said many of the things I've said before. What counts is, are they prepared to really impose it, not just on themselves but on others? Now, you asked a question of what Hamas would have to see in exchange. The whole Mecca agreement was a Swiss cheese agreement, as some have said, has more holes than it had parts. There are things that Hamas is going to have to see in terms of integrating the PLO, in terms of reforming the security sector, so that what happened in the events surrounding the Gaza takeover would not happen again. This is a long-term process, rebuilding the PLO, rebuilding security services. It's a long-term process, and of course, Hamas is going to want to hear something in exchange for whatever concessions it would make. I don't think it's simply, I mean, they would want to be able to run in elections and to have those elections
results respected if they were to run again. But I think the main thing in terms of their dispute with Fatah has to do with power sharing in the PLO and power sharing on the security sector. One last point, cause it, and it's a point that's come up quite a bit in this conversation. Well, first, I didn't answer your question about causality. There are many factors that explain Fatah's failure, Hamas's success, the failure of the peace process in the West Bank. Absolutely right. And I'm not trying to attribute one causal factor more weight than the other. What I'm saying is I think you could find a pretty straight line between some of the things that have been done, again, documented in terms of what's happening in Gaza, the fact that Hamas has deepened its control of Gaza directly as a result of some of the policies that have been put in place, the fact that the PA has withdrawn, the fact that the international community has withdrawn. That gave carte blanche to Hamas to do virtually anything it wanted. And it brings me to the other point, which is, again, my final point, which is about whether there are differences, divisions within Hamas. I mean, Rob is quite right that those differences don't amount to the two-state solutionists versus the one-state solutionists. That's not the division. But I think it would be quite wrong to deny the fact that there are tensions within Hamas, tensions that were exacerbated at the time of the takeover. Again, we document, and people speaking on the record criticizing what happened in Gaza, people in Gaza criticizing the attitude of those in the West Bank. There are differences. There are different attitudes. There are different interests, mainly. Khaled Mishal, sitting in Damascus, may not care that much whether Mahmoud Zahar is in control of Gaza. He has a broader agenda, which is his role in the PLO and being able to steer the national movement in one direction rather than another. The people with the guns in Gaza have a different interest. The religious leaders have a third set of interests. What policymakers can do is try to change the conditions on the ground to make it harder for some people to thrive rather than others. I don't think it's in our interest for the gunmen in Gaza to be in control, because they have a pretty limited agenda, which is the one that you described earlier. But part of what's happening now, part of what's happened since the elections, is that those who argued not for a two-state solution, but those who argued for Hamas's political involvement, have less and less arguments to make. The election results were not respected. Their opponents tried to arm Fatah, et cetera, et cetera. So their case is, forget about all that. Our only chance is to stick to what we have, control Gaza, and we'll hold on to it, and then someday the same will happen in the West Bank. Not everyone within Hamas agrees or likes that line of thinking, and what part of what's happened over the last 2 years, but particularly since June, has been a set of policies that have strengthened those I think we should be most concerned about, also strengthening a jihadi strain within Gaza that has been burgeoning for some time. I'm not saying we want to do Khaled Mishal any favors. That's not my point. I'm saying that there's a more dangerous strand within Hamas that I don't see why it would be in our interest to strengthen. And certainly we don't want what comes after Hamas to be another version of the Salafi jihadism that we've seen popping up around the region. That would be even worse than what we have today. And I think that some of the policies that are being implemented now, unfortunately, are promoting it.
Well, we've had a very, I think, vigorous debate on these issues. I think we ended up on some of the most fundamental points: long-term strategy. Is it a good idea for Israel? Really, it's Israel's decision. Is it a good idea for Israel to risk a long-term threat? It's really letting the fox into the chicken coop, and then protecting yourself from inside the chicken coop rather than keeping the fox outside the chicken coop. Jerome's question about democratic procedure. Again, I come back to the point. This is not Republicans and Democrats. We're not talking, in my view, a parliamentary debate. What are the appropriate ways of engaging in parliamentary debate? This really comes down to fundamental strategy and what flows from choices about fundamental strategy. When all is said and done, I think we have a very practical debate. Rob's argument is current strategy has failed. Let's change strategy. My argument is we didn't even try our current strategy. We undermined the current strategy, what was the right strategy, by putting on the burden on that strategy, the mandate, to use a electoral term from our current presidential campaign, the mandate of achieving a diplomatic agreement by the end of the year. We must be patient, and we must pursue the right approach, which is building Palestinian capacity building in the West Bank, building security infrastructure in the West Bank, enabling the West Bank to be a more well-functioning entity, and then over time that will be a different pole of political attraction for Palestinians than what is going on in Gaza. Now, I am perfectly supportive of an idea of what I of say the mini ceasefire. This understanding, you don't shoot, we don't shoot. You know, that is a that is certainly a reasonable position for any Israeli government to take. If that comes to pass, I think it would benefit overwhelmingly Israeli citizens. I am worried and skeptical about the political implications of the big ceasefire and what it means for actually strengthening Hamas rather than undermining it. And I think with that, I'll adjourn this session to a close. Thank you very much for joining us today.